The word of God is alive and powerful, sharpening a two-edged sword, piercing into the dividing the center of the soul and the spirit, the joints and the marrow. It's a critic of the thoughts and intents of the heart. All scripture is God-breathed and is profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, instruction, righteousness, that the man of God might be mature, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman is not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. We are continuing in our studies this morning in Genesis chapter 26, where we're in the analysis of verses 1 through 6. Pick up probably around page 5 of our notes. The local church is a classroom of Christianity. It's this environment with this academic setting that's established for believers to come together in assembly, in fellowship, to study the truth of Bible doctrine, to advance themselves and enlighten themselves in regards to God's plan for their life with respect to His directive will and obviously His other wills in addition. And obviously in order to apprehend the truth undistorted by the sin nature, it demands that each and every one of us are in fellowship. So as is our custom for every Bible class, we'll give you again another opportunity to rebound if necessary. And then evidence your being in fellowship through, once again, giving me your undivided attention and orientation to my pastoral authority. And therefore, see what God's plan has for us. And all these things are designed to encourage us, to help us to persevere in our Christian lives so that we can maintain on the glory road, so to speak, in this respect, and hold to the end. So with that in mind, we'll give you opportunity to rebound again as we start with our normal word of prayer. Father, though every man be a liar, your word stands forever. We thank you for the truth of your word. We thank you that there is this light in the midst of Satan's darkness, that we are not lost, that we have salvation at hand. It is provided, it is a given, that all we have to do is seek you, seek your word for our lives, your plan for our lives, and implement it in application. And we will indeed be delivered in regards to the domain of darkness, in all aspects of it, both in time as well as eternity. We ask once again this morning that God the Holy Spirit will enlighten the truth in the matters at hand. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, chapter 26, again, moves forward in the narrative chronologically, past the event of Esau selling his birthright to his brother Jacob. This puts the sons at least around 17 years old, if not older, at that point in time. And hence, it places us past the death of Abraham, who would have passed if they were 17 at the time of this incident, 2 years prior to the selling of the birthright. The fact that Esau and Jacob are not mentioned in the narrative further lends an extended period of time as they were independent adults, not saying that they didn't go and relocate also in their own right, but that they are seen to be aloof and hence independent, and that could place us even further ahead in our narrative. Chronologically, we're looking at some 12 to 25 years probably in that area after Abraham's death, that the events recorded for us here in chapter 26 occur. The first 17 verses documents for us Isaac relocating to Gerar. And we are told now in verses 1 through 6 why he moved from the Negev to Gerar, the Philistine area. And that is, as we've seen, because another famine occurs during his time, similar to the one Abraham faced when he went into the land of Canaan all the way back in chapter 12, rereading verse 1. Now there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. The phrase "in the days of Abraham" otherwise tells us that we're looking at him in the past, and hence his death has already occurred in this regard in the scenario at hand. And as we will see, there is a parallel that is to be associated between father and son. of the covenants. This parallel actually has another parallel, and that is between the Abimelechs and their intervention or their involvement in regards to Abraham and Isaac in regards to their own lives. And that is two kings, not the same king. It is a title for a king of Philistine there, known to Abimelech, known to be Abimelech. Because of this famine, continuing verse 1, so Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And the language, the situations, by all indications, most logically looks at two different individuals here, not the same as otherwise may be proposed by some. Not that it's going to make you crash and burn spiritually one way or the other, but based on my readout on it, that's the best I see in regards to it. Now, verses 2 through 5 here are parenthetical in regards to Isaac going to Gerar, to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, and it actually answers why he did go to that location, specifically Gerar. The parenthesis itself, the markers are established there in verse 1b, and then verse 6 that concludes, so Isaac lived in Gerar. Hence, the most natural reading of continuity is going to Gerar and then living or dwelling in Gerar, denoting your bookmark parenthetical ends in surrounding the explanation here, verses 2 through 5. And we're given the reason why, what prompted him to go to Gerar, and that is a Christophany that occurred in his life. Verse 2, and the Lord appeared to him. Now, this is not the first time you've heard Yahweh speak, but this is the first time recorded that he has seen a manifestation or a presence of Yahweh in a physical way. Here as Christ in the flesh, if you will, the Son. And he gives him commands, first negative and then positive. Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I will tell you. In verse 3, he extends then the reasoning of why the commands are given. Sojourn in this land and I will be with you and bless you. A promise of blessing on his behalf in orientation to hear God's geographical will for him. For to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands. Verse 3, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. And I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and will give your descendants all these lands, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth literally will bless themselves. Verse 5, because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws, again ending the insertion, parenthetical insertion, so Isaac lived in Gerar. So, the command here, the first one in the negative, is obviously telling Isaac to refrain from relocating his industry, his people, to Egypt. And this obviously, by implication, suggests strongly that he was considering this move. And if he did, the principle is he would violate God's geographical will for his life, just as his father Abraham did on his part, which we brought out in regards to those analyses, that Abraham was out of line geographically in regards to bolting from the land of Canaan during this period of testing. And Isaac is warned by Yahweh here with Bible doctrine, obviously, to confine any change that he might make in regards to finding relief or seeking relief from his economic and survival situation here, to stay in God's geographical will, that is Canaan, which verse 3 emphasizes in that respect. And the doctrinal principle presented is for Isaac to maintain the general location of Canaan as the parameters of movement, and God then would direct him as to a specific area that would provide him relief from the test. So, obviously, if we can take this, we can apply this today in regards to any testing we may have in regards to financial or economic testing otherwise in this regards, and that is that we are to maintain God's geographical will. Obviously, we understand under his geographical will, his right pastoral will for the sheep, right shepherd, right congregation in that regards, and the believer is free to investigate, obviously, look for open doors. Otherwise, all this, obviously, should be done with prayer and guidance in this regard for God to provide for them maybe another job, a different job or whatever, to give them that relief they're looking for economically otherwise. And God, if when one is faithful, see, part of the test, part of the pressure is, I could do better, if I move 50 miles away, or if I move, to another state, another region. That's the pressure. That's the test put on the cosmos. People in the personnel type of industry, employment placement industry, will tell you generally straight off the bat, if you're willing to relocate, I can help you advance in your profession a lot faster. See, well, for those who are adhering to God's geographical and pastoral will for their lives, obviously this is something that they have to remove from the table in regards to their options. It's one of those things that a lot of believers are just not willing to accept. And they distort the doctrine of right shepherd, right congregation, that just means that you can only have one pastor at a time. That's not what the verse says. It says they won't listen to another voice. Doesn't sound like one pastor at a time. It means they're hooked in, see. They have found their right communicator in that regards. Now, obviously, God may provide legitimate reasons for one to relocate. Generally, the excuses you hear and see by those who are moving around, etc., within the circles, obviously, in denominational ville, that's no issue. And they got a church, anywhere. And, of course, a right pastor, a right shepherd, generally, it is not even part of their frame of reference. It's just, well, I go to a Baptist church or a Methodist church, whatever. And it's all that matters, see. So anyway, doctrine obviously has more stringent guidelines when one correctly evaluates the situation at hand based on what the Bible teaches rather than what men want to come up with in regards to their own traditions or human viewpoint otherwise. So here, Isaac is warned, don't mess up like your dad on this occasion. Obviously, fear is a motivating factor in regards to, well, where's my next meal coming from, or how am I going to support my business, or whatever. As well as other aspects that one may use to rationalize going that direction. And even though the destiny now specifically is not mentioned in our verses, it's understood to be Gerar. And that's based on the parenthetical bookends of verse 1b and verse 6 in regards to giving the reasoning why he went there. So further, it is implied with the verb stay here in regards to Gerar versus Canaan being in view in the first part of the verse here, in verse 2, stay in the land which I shall tell you. That word stay is shekan in the Hebrew. That means tabernacle. It's different than the verb we'll see in verse 3, to sojourn in the land. And that looks at establish a fairly temporary residency, to tent. A tabernacle means a tent. That's what the tabernacle was. It was a mobile tent, elaborate. mobile tent. But a tent nevertheless, where they could pack it up and move it on notice. And obviously fits with the language that the location he tells them is going to be Gerar in this respect for his temporary relocation to find relief in regards to the famine. So just pick up point 37, page 5 of our notes here. In this case, because of divine intervention, Isaac did not react and succumb to fear, leaving the geographical will in order to survive. A lot of times that's the pressure. You got issues, you got tests, run. USDA often says, run. Get under energy of the flesh, figure out how to resolve this thing otherwise. And run from your problems. Well, the problems still exist no matter how you run. You can't run fast enough. See? And you got to understand, in our testing in life, it's designed for us to evaluate and critique ourselves and see where we may have weaknesses in our Christian life as well as our strengths. See? And where we may have problems spiritually. And opportunities to evaluate, pray about it, and seek to address the problems, at least at its primary level, if it's necessary, through rebound or other adjustments in regards to orientation to God's plan. Testing is good for that. I mean, otherwise, you wouldn't know you had a problem. If God didn't test us and everything was just hunky-dory all the time, how would we look at ourselves? Well, we're fine, even though you may be a complete spiritual buffoon in life, see. So testing is obviously designed to help us address our weaknesses. And one of the weaknesses we see in the patriarchs and in parallel with Abraham and Isaac is sin fear. Now, Isaac is given doctrine here to address that. And he takes it to heart. Now, in the next occasion, his sin fear will expose itself. And he'll fail just like his dad did in that regard. But the difference is that he remains in God's geographical will. Whereas the first time, Abraham, during the famine, bolted. So Abraham failed twice on that occasion. Once outside the geographical will of God, one still within with the same region. So this whole thing in regards to knocking off some guy to grab some beautiful trophy wife they have was not probably an uncommon practice. That's the conclusion I've come to. It was a practice. But anyway, so 38, Isaac avoided following the error of his father's experience of radical relocation. 39, it appears, however, that he is on the verge of repeating his father's survival mode, accepting for the intervention. And that illustrates that when we are facing temptation in regards to doctrine, by being in God's geographical will and maintaining fellowship with God, seeking His will in our lives, doctrine is provided for us in order to avoid, if we so choose, to make gross error in our life. So 40, he was not to think here that just because Dad did it, God graced out, that somehow make it all right. I guess I forgot my word make there. So that's another thing you'll see people, believers, rationalizing. Well, so-and-so did it. You hear that from kids. It's a sign of immaturity, by the way. Well, so-and-so does it. And they got one. Whatever. Well, that's not any excuse. And in spite of, I mean, obviously Abraham was as positive as they'd come. And yeah, he did get graced out twice over the situation. But does that make it right? Well, it's just a fact of life. Obviously, a failure under the SCA. We recognize that. But it doesn't condone it. And the proper attitude is to evaluate all things with Bible doctrine. And just because somebody else makes an error in their life, in a certain area of their life, doesn't mean that we need to example that in our own lives. To learn and be wise otherwise, and seek to refrain. But anyway. I know there that's an inherent danger in regards to parents and children to talk about their past sometimes. But, you know, you let them know that you're stupid, then what else can you do? But 41, now verses 3 through 5 here in the explanation of why to relocate to Gerar. Represents the first reiteration of the covenant promises to Abraham's son. That is, in regards to the real estate descendancy clause of the covenant. 42, his hearing of the promises here directly from Yahweh on this occasion, again, was not the first time he had heard him speak. 43, on the mountain in Genesis 22:11 and following, during his near sacrifice, Isaac heard the promises when God took an oath before his father on that occasion. 44, however, this is the first time recorded that Isaac saw Yahweh in Christophany. Second member of the Godhead manifested as the incarnate Christ, if you will, as humanity. The Lord appeared. 45, now the reiterated covenant promises here are designed to encourage Isaac not to ever violate God's geographical will for him, as it is imperative to secure maximum blessing. It's imperative to secure maximum blessing. Stay in Canaan, so I can bless you to the maximum. And it's kind of cool how he breaks it down here, Yahweh does, in these verses. 47, this further illustrates the importance of maintaining the geographical will in the believer's life, apart from being oriented to and plugging into one's right local church, right shepherd. One cannot expect to fulfill their phase two and grow up spiritually if it's not done according to divine design. It's not going to happen. People may conjure up their magical, mystical, human viewpoint approaches otherwise, but it's still not going to happen if you don't do it according to God, the divine will in this respect, God's directive will and geographical will. And when you're within your right canon, then you are in the periphery to hear the doctrine necessary to address your test in life. When you leave that, you dismiss it, abandon it, you remove that protection and that guidance otherwise that God designed through God the Holy Spirit to give you. So 48, the phrase, sojourn in the land, now emphasizes Canaan as the general boundary he is to maintain for his phase 2. So verse 2 looks to Gerar that Yahweh will tell him where to go. It want Yahweh to tell you where to go? Oh, here you go. He's doing it. Go to Gerar. Now verse 3, it emphasizes the land of Canaan in and of itself, in the particular area that Gerar still is it within the boundaries, according to the abstract of the real estate pact, covenant in this regard. So 49, any sojourning, any traveling about, of Isaac's travel is to be restricted to Canaan. Made specific in the Hebrew, the land, this one. No other, this one. 50, now the exact wording, and I will be with you, is here first used in connection with divine reassurance to Isaac, and repeated exactly in the Hebrew to Jacob, returning to land after his time in Padan Aram, where he spent some time with his uncle Laban, pursuing a wife in his life. Ends up to be two, not in the order that he would prefer. It's one of those situations you look at, in spite of getting graced out, God did not grease his skids in regards to this stuff. I mean, when we get to Jacob, just keep in mind how God provided for Isaac his right woman. He's just doing his thing, and all of a sudden, God comes and drops her off, his servant. See? Jacob, he's out there working his tail end off to get his right woman. See? So, these contrasts are there. Obviously, based on recall, for a purpose to encourage us to do the right way, to go the right way in regards to these things. But anyway, after his time there, he finally recognizes he needs to move, and God specifically tells Jacob, go back to the land and I will bless you. Not that God left him, obviously, aspects of life otherwise, he was still was positive. He's just acting immaturely under energy of flesh for a period of his time. Alright, so 51, and we'll see that in Genesis 31:3 in that chapter. 51, now it in principle points to orientation to God's geographical will. I will be with you in the land, sojourn in the land. It points, in principle, to orientation of God's geographical will for maintained fellowship with Him and confidence of His presence for a successful phase two. Yeah, I hear it. Well, you know, if I'm out of line, I go somewhere else and abandon God's geographical will, I can rebound that. Well, yeah. Yeah, you can rebound that. You can get back in fellowship. And if it's God's will, His geographical will for you to be there, then under reversion recovery, well, fine. We understand that. But if it's one of those situations where you never really acknowledge that you're wrong, what good is your rebound doing? Every time you go someplace else, the Bible class or to church or whatever you're pursuing, and you're not under God's geographical will, how long is your fellowship lasting? This one, obviously, I will be with you. Looks at continuation of fellowship with God. And that in turn is what provides us confidence. Yeah, I have those thoughts running. I'd like to live somewhere warmer during the winter too. I'm finally getting to that point, 20 years living here now. Okay, yeah, I see where you're coming from. You know. But, you'd be, that you, if you did, you'd be in violation big time. And there is something in a great way to be said, to know that you're doing it right. The constant doctrine that you hear reinforces your decision. And over time, it gives you confidence as God continually evidences that He is with you and continue to bless you in your niche, no matter what it may be. So hanging in there builds confidence, the consistent fellowship with God, and the spiritual advance and matriculation that one's making bolsters us up to handle the tough times.
All right, 52. Now for the blessing aspect here, for bless you, or simply our word Barak, we saw it with respect to Abraham in 12:2. Same phrase. I'll make you a great nation, and I will bless you, Abraham, personally. 22:17. After passing the test with Isaac on the mountain, indeed, I will greatly bless you. And we'll see again here in verse 24. As Yahweh appears to Isaac, I'm the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham. So 53, the blessing here emphasizes the maximum blessing. Phase 2 and phase 3. With doctrine, you see the subtle differences here in these verses. Verse 3a looks at maximum blessing, which is conditional of staying in the land. See, fulfilling God's will, applying God's will in his life, and maximum blessing. Phase 2, then, as it would apply to phase 3, in the extenuation of Yahweh's word and reiteration of the covenant, as we will see, we'll move into the unconditional aspects of the covenant. So it's just one of those little things that you have to recognize and understand to have a really clear read in regards to what Yahweh is telling Isaac in this occasion. So the first part of the verse, verse 3, emphasizes maximum blessing, phase 2 and phase 3. So 54, now the promises then have future unconditional ramifications. For to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands. He goes on to explain in regards to that which provides the foundation for blessing as it centers on the land and on his descendancy, etc. In the Hebrew, that's ki lamed wa lamed zera nethan kol ha eretz ha el. 55, the unconditional elements now of the covenant. So, this is a promise, it's a future certainty. I will give you, for I will give you these things. See? So that looks to the unconditional, nothing that Isaac or his descendants have to do in order for these promises to be fulfilled. So the unconditional elements of the covenant, point 55, provide the foundation as to the maximum blessing promise. The foundation has been laid. This is why Yahweh is free to bless phase 2, phase 3 in a maximum way in regards to Isaac. Under the spiritual terms of the covenant, that which it teaches in terms of salvation, expressed physically in regards to literal real estate and descendancy otherwise. But there's also spiritual descendancy as we understand the underlying conditions of the covenant. So the unconditional elements of the covenant provide the foundation as to the maximum blessing promised. 56, the unconditional aspect of covenant here centers now on salvation phase 1. Trying to put this together for you, how this unconditional aspect and why they're brought in this reason. I'm going to try to give you the reason why Esau finds his cause in Abraham, not in Isaac, as verse 4 will tell us. So the unconditional aspect of covenant, point 56, centers on salvation phase 1 with certain blessings of citizenship and heritage by association with Christ, guaranteed apart from the works of man.
So, providing the spiritual picture of the covenant in terms of unconditional aspects of it, conditional aspects, as we have done in with the doctrine and otherwise. We see now, if Isaac will orient and obey God in regards to God's geographical will, he will in turn receive maximum blessing that extends into phase three. And this finds its foundation on unconditional elements of the covenant, which obviously now represents phase one in regards to the deliverance package embedded in the covenant itself. 57, the sequence "for to you," followed by, quote, "to your descendants," end quote, highlights his heritage by association. "For to you and to your descendants" highlights heritage by association. His descendants are in association with him, and his associations with Abraham. A chain reaction. 58, now the phrase "I will give" highlights the grace behind the unconditional elements. It is a gift. See, these are offered as a gift. And salvation phase one is presented in those terms. It's a free gift of God. Not based on anything that we do to earn or deserve it. It's provided for all men under the doctrine of unlimited atonement. So 59, there is nothing they can do to earn or deserve possession of this real estate. Now, the land's theirs. Now, their occupation of it is a different story, as the Mosaic Law will bring out the conditional aspect of their possession of the land, but it doesn't mean that the land still doesn't belong to them. God's just jammed and he's kicked them out. They're not allowed to come back into the house until they get their act together. You don't like it, leave. You move back home when you get your stuff together, see. So the phrase "I will give" reflects upon the fact that there's nothing they can do or earn or deserve possession of this real estate. 60, now all these lands, that phrase, is all inclusive of the territory that was described again in the abstract of Genesis 15, 18 through 21, where God cut the covenant, the legal document, if you will, through the ritual of the animals, dividing them in half, and then he provided in that contract, the abstract, from the river of Egypt, which is not the Nile River, contrary to what many commentaries will tell you. It's a smaller river that basically divides the Sinai Peninsula from the continent east, Arabia east, all the way to the river Euphrates. The property that Israel has today is just a spit in the bucket in regards to the entire boundary that God gave. And then that's the east-west boundaries. Then the north-south is Mediterranean Sea, Great Sea. And then however far down the tribes of people that was mentioned in that abstract, Hittites, etc., occupied. So much of Iraq, those areas will soon be in the hands of Israel. One of these days. So all these lands is inclusive of the territory described in the abstract of Genesis 15, 18 through 21. That's to be understood, even though it may be somewhat minimized in regards to the actual presence where Isaac's at. But he would understand it, that the boundaries obviously extend beyond. 61, again, the Hebrew is specific. As in the Hebrew, is all of the lands. These ones. That's awkward in the English, but that's what it is.
these lands. Now the covenant promise on this occasion, and on this occasion alone, is referred to here as an oath, or Hebrew word shabuah, connected with the promise of Genesis 22 on the Mount of Sacrifice, rather than with the standard noun covenant, which is berith. So that then, as you're interpreting all this, is a reminder of Abraham's phase two positive volition, and the epitome and evidence of his phase two positive volition and maturity, adjustment, and his willingness to kill his son and bring forth the doctrine of faith rest in regards to everything else surrounding it. See? And that's that understanding is necessary as you get into the next verse, as this all is the cause of Abraham's obedience, etc., etc. But anyway, he did the advantage of looking ahead. So 63, now that God, quote, will establish, literally cause to stand, our Hebrew word kum, the hifil causative verb, that God will cause to stand the sworn oath, teaches that it is only by the power of God that the unconditional elements of the promise are sustained. See, all this fits right in regards to how we understand phase one salvation. Salvation is provided by God. It's maintained, sustained by God. There's nothing that we can do to help God out, keep it, and you know, keep it in attack for us. It's dependent on Him to begin with. Why would it be dependent on us to finish it off? So it is through God's omnipotence that salvation is made possible and sustained. Our so great salvation. Not a single one of these that the Father gives me will I lose. Will it fall out of the Father's hand. God's in control. God's in control of our salvation. So all those things that are pertinent to phase one blessings in life, they're there, they're given, and God upholds their existence and their fulfillment through His power. So 64 is the guarantee by God that nothing can thwart the blessings promised in the covenant apart from the believer's obedience or disobedience to his plan respectively. And obviously their obedience, phase one, is faith in, faith for salvation apart from works. Phase two, obedience, obviously towards Bible doctrine. The object of faith is doctrine. The object of faith, phase one, is Jesus Christ. And whether one exercises faith or not determines whether they're a part of the star descendancy. It can be dust, but to be a star descendancy, one needs to be a believer, not just racially related. It must be spiritually related. So, 65. Now, verse 4 replays chapter 22, 17 through 18a in the oath that God made to Abraham, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven, and your seed will possess the gate of their enemies. So, Yahweh replays those promises, reiterates them in other words. I will multiply your descendants of the stars of heaven. I will give your descendants all these lands. So chapter 22, 17 through 18 is restated now in these words, in other words, that are designed to parallel promises to Abraham. 66, now the reference to the seed being multiplied as, quote, sand on seashore, back in chapter 22, which emphasizes racial descendants, 22:17b, here it is truncated to stars of the heaven, simply stars of the heaven, Kokav HaShamayim. So 67, this to highlight the spiritual realities embedded in the unconditional aspects of the covenant. That we refer to covenant in terms of salvation phase 1, salvation phase 2. There's a reason, because there's spiritual principles that is intertwined, embedded in regards to this covenant, that makes the covenant for what it is. Without these spiritual principles, the covenant means nothing. See? So here, the language is simply stars in heaven to emphasize for those who have done their work beforehand, recognizing that that looks at those who follow Abraham an example in faith. See? And we have example that stars represent believers in that regard. Psalm 147, verse 4. He counts the numbers of the stars. That's Yahweh. He gives names to all of them. The implication is believers are that exist in time. God knows them individually. And the stars are representative of believers in that verse. Then confer 1 Corinthians 15:41. As believers are likened to heavenly bodies in terms of resurrection and glory associated with resurrection. As we know, not everybody will be equal in their manifestation, in their resurrection bodies of glory. That's going to be dependent on what you do with doctrine and time, or don't do. And Paul here makes his analogy to show this contrast and differences. There are also heavenly bodies, verse 40, and earthly bodies, but the glory of the heavenly is one, the glory of the earthly is another. There are different types. There's one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars, for star differs from star in glory. So also is the resurrection of the dead. See, as stars are analogized as being believers in resurrection body. The son of perishable body is raised an imperishable body. So 68, then the second part here of the words iterated to Abraham, possessing the gates of enemies, back in chapter 22, is here substituted with simply, and will give your descendants all these lands. Wow, Nathan, Lamed, Zerah, Eth, Kol, Ha, Eretz, El. 69, the promise now assumes the victory over their enemies as a given, with the unconditional elements of promise in place. Which fits, because Abraham still is working out, or still doing his phase two, in spite of how the fact that he's reached maturity and the epitome is evidence in regards to sacrifice of Isaac. Not until he's dead is his phase two over. At any time, understand, even though God foreknew he wouldn't, but at any time he was free to choose. He could have crashed and burned even after that. You would think, wow, nobody was that great a believer could do that. Well, better be check that kind of thinking. Saul was a pretty good believer, and he crashed and burned to begin with. I mean, he had his act together big time. See, he was anointed by God to be the king. God doesn't just anoint every Tom, Dick, and Harry. He anoints Saul, Paul, and whoever, huh? But anyway, so this is pretty cool. I mean, when you look at it from these perspectives. Abraham's still working out his phase two. He's still got to live it out. He's completed it. Now, I will make give you the gates of the enemies, is a given. It's 100% given. You're beyond. He was successful. There's nothing he could do now to ever mess that up again, because his phase two is over. So it's simply stated as a given. I will give you, your descendants, all these lands. Your enemies are defeated. It's like Christ going to the cross, and we looking back in time, it's a given. See, salvation has been performed. It's been executed. There's nothing that can ever overturn that. And so you have the same kind of language now that's being used regards to the covenant in terms, or the words that are expressed here, in contrast to from Abraham to Isaac, as Abraham has secured that on behalf of those who will follow his example by living out his phase two, completing his course, going out under dying grace in this regard. So 69, the promise now assumes the victory over their enemies as a given with the unconditional elements of place promise in place. 70, again, God's grace and omnipotence is to be understood as that which will secure this victory. Again, the giving is emphasized. I will give your descendants all these lands. That highlights grace. It highlights God's power in making this possible. Apart from anything else that one may do, they can't do anything, really. In addition to it, they can't add to it. 71, then the all-important subset of the descendant and real estate clauses then is the messianic promise, which is the final part of the this section here. In your seed, literally, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Again, a promise that was made to Abraham originally in the covenant, chapter 12, verse 3, reiterated in 22:18, and it will be restated again in 28:14. Your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth. You shall spread out to the west and the east and the north and the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So 72, obviously this is fulfilled in the first advent of Jesus Christ, who brought eternal salvation to humanity through his death and resurrection. That's where it finds its fulfillment. 73, it is through Christ that the unconditional blessings are made possible and guaranteed. 74, the evidence will be revealed via the second advent when he returns and he rules planet Earth from his throne in Israel, and all of his enemies will be defeated as their blood rises to the force of the battle at the Battle of Armageddon. Prior to that era of history. All right, let's take our break.